I read your letter while walking on white sand burning my bare feet. I looked out at the water so clear blue it hurt my eyes. Last night, Mama made us griot and jiyue pois, and Christian, who can smell a good meal from between a woman's thighs, finally came home. The three of us ate together and we laughed. There wasn't much food, but what there was enough. I'll tell you this. We do not enjoy as much food as perhaps once we did. When Christian goes to get rice from Minusta, he must take his gun, three friends. Some mornings we wake, our stomachs empty, our stomachs angry. But never do we look to the ground beneath our feet with longing in our mouths. We chew on our pride, the dirt we do not eat. What you need to know about a Haitian woman. When his wife was a young girl, she was playing with a young chick in the yard, chasing after it, laughing, having fun. When the mother hen realized her child was being teased, she ran across the dusty yard and began pecking at his not-yet-wife's legs. His future mother-in-law, upon seeing her child being hen-pecked, ran outside, raised the mother hen in the air, and snapped its neck. Later, she had the chicken prepared for dinner. She said it was the best meal she ever ate. When the mother hen's chicks grew up, she killed them too. The point, the Haitian father will then say to a potential suitor, is this. You don't need to worry about him. You need to worry about the mother. Of Ghosts and Shadows. I am watching my lover, Amélie, move through the market, sifting through items neither of us can hope to afford. It is stinking hot, the kind of hot where it feels like even my eyeballs are sweating, and I want nothing more than to jump into the salty water of the ocean for respite. I am watching my lover because it is too dangerous to do anything but watch. Her face is thin and drawn, but when her fingers dance across a trinket she likes, her eyes light up and the muscles in her shoulders relax. I imagine that she is imagining what it would be like to own these petty items she covets. There are a few tourists in the market, walking around, confused, as if they read the wrong brochure. Most Americans come to Haiti expecting it to be like Aruba or St. Kitts. They lump all of these small islands into one paradise where libations flow freely and cabana boys are waiting to attend to their every need. Unfortunately for them, the cabana boys have all fled the country and there is no ice to cool their drinks. Amélie and I have known each other since we were children. Our mothers are best friends, and together we watched our fathers taken away for supporting free elections. We watched our brothers disappear into the countryside or the ocean. And we watched each other. We always watched each other. Once, as we sat on her front porch drinking mango juice, holding the cool glasses to our foreheads between sips, she turned to me and she said, "Sometimes, Marie-Françoise, you are the only thing in this world I care to see." A gaggle of schoolchildren noisily push their way past me, and just looking at them makes me want to cry. They are so young, not so innocent, and they too want things they cannot have. Amélie looks up and smiles at me. No one else could recognize it as a smile, but I know. Her eyelids are raised, lips slightly curled at the edges, her thumb grazing her chin. I cock my head to the side and pretend to be interested in a box of cornflakes selling for $13. I smooth one eyebrow and draw my finger down my cheek. This is my way of smiling at her. Telling her that I wish I could touch her face, hold her hand as we shop, whisper futile fantasies of what we wish was but cannot be. Slowly, I move toward her, ignoring the bony elbows, gaunt faces, tired old women sucking their lips. My heart pounds with each step. The sharp twinge between my thighs melts into a gentle throb. I should stay away, but I am feeling rebellious today. I enjoy torturing myself with this dance of being so close yet so far. When I am finally next to her, I carefully inspect a handful of patterned beads with my left hand, my right loosely by my side, two fingers reaching toward the worn pink fabric of her dress, one of only three she owns. She leans into me, and I can feel the light pressure of her thigh against my finger, her bare arm against mine. She turns, and I can feel her staring at me. I force myself to look forward, but it feels like she is reaching inside my body with her eyes, reaching past skin, bone, and blood to my heart. I slide my fingers upward, along the round edges of her hip to her waist. In another time, or another place, or if I were another person, I would stand behind her, graze the back of her neck with my lips. I would wrap my arms around her for a moment of comfort before taking her hand to continue strolling through the market. But since we are here, and now, I step away as I notice a group of young, angry men walking toward us. I doubt that there is any particular reason for their anger. It is the anger that most men feel these days. They are angry about their impotence and their desires and their reality. It is an anger we all feel, but it is an anger only men can freely express. I start walking in the other direction, and though I want to turn around and whisper, "I love you," I keep walking. On days like today, I think I could walk until the muscles in my legs burned in protest, until I drifted into the ocean, until I walked into that time and place where Amélie and I could be together, out in the open. For now, we are women who do not exist. We are less than shadows, more than ghosts. We're the wayward relatives neighbors gossip about in hushed, horrified tones. We are the women people ignore because two women loving each other is an American thing. Not the sort of behavior God-fearing island folk would engage in. There are a few people who live openly, men mostly, artists who are indulged in their bright-colored sashaying about town because their work is so brilliant. But even they meet with contempt now and then. An insult hurled here, a sharp rock thrown there. And when they get sick, they are greeted with smug smiles, a harsh reminder of all good things as their bodies waste to nothing. Amélie and I were caught once, when I was 23 and she was 22. It was late at night and we met in the dark shadows between our houses. Our mothers were asleep, our neighbors were asleep. It was a moment when we were the only two women in the world and we felt a certain freedom, a freedom to do as we pleased. Even beneath the cover of night, it was so hot that we were sweating. There are nights in Haiti when it feels possible that the moon burns just as hot as the sun. She was wearing a t-shirt and old sandals. I was wearing my house coat, the top three buttons open. We clasped hands and sank into the darkest part of that dark space, and we traced each other's faces with our fingers, as if in the space of a few hours since we last saw each other, perhaps our features had changed. I ran my tongue from the tip of her chin to the hollow just beneath her throat. I tasted the salt of sweat and could feel her breath humming just beneath the surface of her skin. We said nothing, but there was no need for words. Everything that could possibly be said had already been spoken between us over the course of so many years. She clasped the back of my neck and lifted my head, bringing my lips to hers, and she kissed me so hard I imagined she could swallow me whole. Our lips were so dry and cracked I tasted blood. My tongue pushed past her lips, running over the sharp edges of her teeth, meeting with hers. And then she pushed me lower, pulling her t-shirt over her narrow shoulders. I took her breasts into my hands, and the soft mounds of flesh spilled through my fingers. Amélie whispered only one word, "Please." So I laid her on the ground, my hands greedily spreading her thighs. The earth beneath our bodies was warm, inviting, generous. And then we heard a gasp, and I knew if I moved, my heart would fall from my chest and into the ground. I knew all my fears were about to come to pass. I have had many such moments. Amélie scrambled away from me, reaching for her t-shirt, wrapping her arms around her chest, as if she could disappear if she sat ever so still. Slowly, I turned my head and saw my mother beneath a thin shaft of moonlight, and the look on her face was so horrified, so distant, I hardly recognized her. She turned and walked away. We never spoke of it, neither me and my mother nor me and my lover, but Amélie and I never met in the dark between our houses ever again. Now, 5 years later, when we want to make love, we steal away to a friend's house when we can, or we get together once in a while with other people like us, women and men who are also less than shadows, more than ghosts. They are sad little affairs, our get-togethers, on Saturday nights in the back room of someone's house in Port-au-Prince. The rum is watered down. We have to pay $10 to get in, and the entire time we try to pretend we are in New York or Miami or Montreal at a club with friends. We try to show each other affection. We try to pretend we aren't staring at the doorway, afraid we'll be caught. And Amélie and I will steal to the bathroom, dark and dank, with little room to move. We'll fumble with our clothing and shove our hands between each other's thighs, kissing for so long that we start breathing for each other, trying to extract as much pleasure from our bodies as possible before we have to return home. On a strangely cool December evening not too long ago, a group of men, boys really, raided our private party. Amélie and I were sitting on a couch, our arms around each other, when five men came through the front door. We could smell drink on them. We could smell hate. Albert, a friend of ours, was by the door, and they grabbed him by his shirt, shoving him against the wall, saying the crudest, cruelest things they could. One of them, tall, fair-skinned, with wide features, threw the stereo on the floor and began beating it with a baseball bat. But for some reason, the music played on. The air was filled with their taunts and the tinny music playing. "Faggots," the man with the bat sneered. For a moment, we froze, 11 of us, hoping our passivity would bring the moment to an end. And then we were running through the house and out the back door, away from that place. We knew we were cowards, but we didn't dare look back. The next day, we heard that Albert was in the hospital with 3 broken ribs, a broken hand, and a chorus of bruises. I mourned for his pain, but I didn't want that to be me, and I didn't want that to be Amélie. It was simply one more shame to bear. The same could be said for all of us. But we continued to meet, continued to defy the rules, because we knew that such stolen moments are the one small thing we have in this big, big world. When I arrive home, my mother is in bed asleep. For the past several years, she has spent most of her time sleeping, and her slumber is understandable. I stand in her doorway listening to the sound of her breathing. It is shallow and timid. The wrinkles in her face are sharp. She looks so relaxed, so at peace, that I can't bear to wake her, disturb her stolen moment. And to wake her would do just that. I see the pain in her face when she looks at me. It is the sorrow of living with a daughter she loves but does not want. There are times when I think of settling down with a man, any man. It would please my mother to no end, but then I think of the scent of Amélie's neck and the flutter of her fingers over mine, and I know that despite the unbearable distance between us, I would not have things any other way. Neither would she. In the kitchen, I prepare myself a mug of café au lait, and though the air is hot, even indoors, I hold my face over the steam, my pores opening. From the window, I can see directly into Amélie's house. I sit there and wait to watch her return home from the market. Her mother waves from the porch, and I offer her a shy smile, a careful wave, and then I look away before my face says too much. I sit for hours, and I think of the last time Amélie and I made love, how fleeting it was, how hungry it has left me. I think of her sticky thighs rubbing against each other as she walks, and I think of her in the market, and the warmth of her thigh pressing against the edge of my fingertips. So many stolen moments. The first time we made love was a shy and awkward affair. I was 19, she had just turned 18, and as we walked home from school, the cracked pavement burning through the thin soles of our shoes, I grabbed her hand with mine, clenching it so tightly my knuckles turned white. She stopped and stared at me. I opened my mouth, but there were no words. But there were words, I simply didn't know how to wrap my lips around them. In the distance, a lone Toyota ambled toward us, but I closed my eyes, leaned into her, and brushed my lips across hers. I traced the arch of her eyebrow with one finger, and then I ran away, trying not to cry. She called after me, but when I turned around, she wasn't following me, so I kept running, off the road and through a cane field, ignoring the brambles that scratched my skin, until I reached my house. My mother clutched her chest when she saw me, but I shook my head and retired to my bedroom, where I sat on the cool concrete floor in a corner, my arms wrapped around my knees, rocking back and forth. Moments later, there was a light knock on the door. "Go away," I said hoarsely. But the wooden door slowly creaked open, and there Amélie stood, pale, lips pursed. She stepped inside my room and closed the door behind her. Why did you do that? She asked. I lowered my head, staring at the floor. She moved closer, close enough for me to smell sweat and the lingering scent of her perfume. She knelt, her knees pressed against mine, and she cupped my face between her hands, and in that moment, she was holding the whole of me. Why did you do that? She asked again. I looked up. I feel things I am not supposed to feel. I want things I am not supposed to want. How do you know that? I laughed bitterly. If you knew, you would turn around. You would never look upon me again. Do you not know me at all? It's not as simple as that. She took my hand in hers, held it between her breasts. Her skin thrummed lightly through her shirt and my fingers trembled. It took all my self-control not to move my hand mere inches to the right or left. And then, her hand covering mine, she slid my hand under her shirt, up the smooth of her stomach, and cupped it around her breast. I sighed a heavy sigh, enjoying the weight of her in the palm of my hand. I had imagined that moment for so long, lying in bed alone on dark, humid nights, that I felt a sharp, intense pain between my eyes, and for a moment, the world went white. Perhaps it is that simple, she said. A single cry escaped the dryness of my throat. I kissed her chin, her neck, pulled her shirt over her shoulders as my mouth fumbled lower. She held me to her, her fingers drawing small circles against the back of my neck. I could hear my mother shuffling around in the kitchen and my heart pounded as I prayed she wouldn't disturb us. I slid my hand beneath the elastic waistband of Amelie's skirt. She remained silent and kneeling, but she parted her thighs, pressed herself against my fingers, though I had no clear idea of what I was doing. Like a distant echo, I could hear my mother calling me to dinner, asking Amelie if she wanted to join us. I could not breathe. It is hours past dark when Amelie finally comes home. As she stands on the threshold of her house, she looks at me, sees me in the shadows, and changes her mind, making her way to my house. I greet her at the door, and she looks so sad, so hollow, that I open my arms and she tumbles against my chest, perching her head against my shoulder. I cannot sleep alone tonight, she whispers. I simply cannot. I lift her chin with a finger, look into her eyes. We could call on Patricia, see if she'd let us spend the night there. Amelie shakes her head. I want to sleep here, in our bed. There are butterflies in my stomach. I did not realize until now that I have always wanted to hear her say those words. My mother is here. I don't care, do you? I think of all the tiny pleasures we have denied ourselves over the years. I cannot deny her this one thing, the only thing she has ever asked of me. Come, I say, leading her to the bedroom. We tiptoe past my mother's bedroom. She is snoring now, but I do not bother to shut her door, nor do I shut mine. Amelie's courage tonight, however blind it may be, makes me want to be just as brave. Her courage makes me wonder if we really have anything to fear, as if it is only ghosts and shadows forbidding our passion. She strips out of her clothes, as do I, and we crawl into my bed, which creaks beneath our weight. She lies on her back, I on my side. She traces my lips with her thumb. Her smile is genuine. The depths of her light brown eyes are fathomless. I see wisdom there, fear, a little happiness, desire. The tension between us is palpable. I wonder if Amelie's mother knows where Amelie is, what her daughter is doing. I exhale loudly. I did not realize I have been holding my breath. Shh, Amelie says, pressing one finger to my lips. I think about how dangerous this is for us. I think about stones striking flesh. My mother could be standing in the doorway, but I do not turn my head. We lie down together. She covers her hand with mine. I fall asleep before I can tell her I love her, listening to the sound of her beating heart and rushing blood. I cannot tell her that she should leave before dawn arrives. I am too tired and too satisfied to be afraid. In the morning, my mother will find us like this, limbs entangled, bodies as one, breathing each other's breath. My mother will think she is seeing ghosts or perhaps shadows. She will be right. a cool, dry place. Eve and I are walking because even if his Citroën was working, petrol is almost $7 a liter. He is wearing shorts, faded and thin, and I can see the muscles of his thighs trembling with exhaustion. He worries about my safety, so every evening at 6, he picks me up at work and walks me home, all in all a journey of 20 kilometers amid the heat, the dust, and the air redolent with exhaust fumes and the sweet stench of sugarcane. We try to avoid the crazy drivers who try to run us off the road for sport. We walk slowly, my pulse quickening as he takes my hand. Eve's hands are what I love best about him. They are calloused and wrinkled, the hands of a much older man. At times, when he is touching me, I know there is wisdom in those hands. We have the same conversation almost every day. What a disaster the country has become. But we cannot even muster the strength to say the word disaster because the word does not describe our lives. There is sadness in Eve's face that also defies description. It is an expression of ultimate sorrow, the reality of witnessing the country, the home you love, disappearing not into the ocean, but into itself. We stop at the market in downtown Port-au-Prince. Posters for Aristide and the Famille Lavalas are all over the place even though the elections, an exercise in futility, have come and gone. A vendor with one leg and swollen arms offers me a package of Tampax for $12, thrusting the crumpled blue and white box toward me. I ignore him as a red-faced American tourist begins shouting at us. He wants directions to the Hotel Montana. He is lost. His map of the city is wrinkled and torn and splotched with cola. We are Haitian, not deaf, I say. The American smiles, relaxes into the comfort of his own language. Eve rolls his eyes and pretends to be fascinated with an art vendor's wares. He has no tolerance for fat Americans. They make him hungry. Hunger reminds him of the many things he tries to ignore. Eve learned English in school. I learned from television. I love Lucy, the Brady Bunch, and my favorite show, The Jeffersons, with the little black man who walks like a chicken. When I was a child, I would sit and watch these shows and mimic the actor's words until I spoke them perfectly. Now, as I tell the red-faced man the wrong directions because he has vexed me, I mouth my words slowly, with what I hope is a flawless American accent. The man shakes my hand too hard and thrusts 5 gourds into my sweaty palm. Eve sucks his teeth as the man walks off and tells me to throw the money away, but I stuff the faded bills inside my bra. We continue to walk around pretending we can afford to buy something sweet or something nice. When we get home, the heat threatens to suffocate us. It always does. The air conditioning window unit is not working because it has been defeated by the on and off of daily power outages. The air is thick and refuses to move. I look at the rivulets of sweat streaming down Eve's dark face, and I want to run away to someplace cool and dry. My mother has prepared dinner, boiled plantains and legumes, a beef and green bean stew. She is weary, sweating, bent, nearly broken. She doesn't speak to us as we enter, nor do we speak to her. There is nothing any of us can say that hasn't already been said. She stares and stares at the black and white photo of my father, a man I have little recollection of. He was murdered by the Makut, the secret military police, when I was only 5 years old. Late at night, I dream of my father being dragged from our home, of his body beaten as he was thrown into the back of a large green military truck. He was the lucky one. Sometimes my mother stares at my father so hard that her eyes glaze over, and she starts rocking back and forth. I look at Eve. I know should anything happen to him, it will be me holding his picture, remembering what was and will never be. I understand our capacity to love. We eat quickly, and after, Eve washes the dishes outside. My stomach still feels empty. I rest my hand over the slight swell of my belly. I want to complain I am still hungry, but I do not. I cannot add to their misery. I catch Eve staring at me through the dirty window as he dries his hands. He always looks at me in such a way that I know his capacity to love equals mine. His eyes are wide, lips parted slightly, as if the words, I love you, are forever resting on the tip of his tongue. He smiles but looks away quickly, as if there is an unspoken rule forbidding such impossible moments of joy. Sighing, I stand and kiss my mother on the forehead, gently rubbing her shoulders. She pats my hand and I retire to the bedroom even I share. I wait. I think about his teeth on my neck and the weight of his body pressing me into our bed. Sex is one of the few pleasures we have left. It is dark when Eve finally comes to bed. As he crawls under the sheets, I can smell rum on his breath. I lie perfectly still until he nibbles my earlobe. Eve chuckles softly. I know you're awake, Gabby. I smile in the darkness and turn toward him. I always wait for you. He gently rolls me onto my stomach and kneels behind me, removing my panties as he kisses the small of my back. His hands crawl along my spine, and again I can feel their wisdom as he takes an excruciating amount of time to explore my body. I arch toward him as I feel his lips against the backs of my thighs and one of his knees parting my legs. I try and look back at him, but he nudges my head forward and enters me in one swift motion. I inhale sharply, shuddering, a moan trapped in my throat. Eve begins moving against me, moving deeper and deeper inside me, and before I give myself over, I realize that the sheets are torn between my fingers, and I am crying. Later, Eve is wrapped around me, his sweaty chest clinging to my sweaty back. He holds my belly in his hands, and I can feel the heat of his breath against the back of my neck. We should leave, he murmurs, so that one day I can hold you like this and feel our child living inside you. I sigh. We have promised each other that we will not bring a child into this world, and it is but one more sorrow heaped onto a mountain of sorrows we share. How many times will we have this conversation? We'll never have enough money for the plane tickets. We'll never have enough money to live here either. Perhaps we should just throw ourselves into the ocean. Eve stiffens and I squeeze his hand. I wasn't being serious. Some friends of mine are taking a boat to Miami week after next. This is another conversation we have too often. Many of our friends have tried to leave on boats. Some have made it, most have not, and too many have turned back when they realize the many miles between Haiti and Miami are not so few as the space on the map implies. They are taking a boat to the middle of the ocean where they will surely die. This boat will make it, Eve says confidently. A priest is traveling. I close my eyes. I try to breathe, yearning for just one breath of fresh air. Because God has done so much to help us here on land? Don't talk like that. He is silent for a moment. I told them we would be going too. I turn around and try to make out his features beneath the moon's shadows. Eve grips my shoulders. Only when I wince does he let go. This is the only thing that does make sense. Agwe will see that we make it to Miami, and then we can go to South Beach and Little Haiti and watch cable TV. My upper lip curls in disgust. You will put your faith in the same God that traps us on this godforsaken island? If we go, we might know once in our lives what it's like to breathe. My heart stops and the room suddenly feels like a big echo. I can hear Eve's heart beating where mine is not. I can imagine what Eve's face might look like beneath the Miami sun. I will follow him wherever he goes. When I wake, I blink, covering my eyes as cruel shafts of sunlight cover our bodies. The sun never has mercy here. My mother is standing at the foot of the bed, clutching the black and white photo of my father. Mama? The walls are thin, she whispers. I stare at my hands. They have aged overnight. Is something wrong? You must go with Eve, Gabrielle, she says, handing me the picture of my father. I stare at the picture, trying to recognize the curve of my eyebrow or the slant of my nose in his features. When I look up, my mother is gone. For the next 2 weeks, I work, and Eve spends his days doing odd jobs and scouring the city for the supplies he anticipates us needing. I go through the motions, straightening my desk, taking correspondence from my boss, gossiping with my coworkers. I am dreaming of Miami and places where Eve and I are never hungry or tired or scared or any of the other things we have become. I tell no one of our plans to leave, but I want someone to stop us, remind me of all the unknowns between here and there. At night, we exhaust ourselves making frantic love. We no longer bother to stifle our voices. I do things I would have never considered before, things I have always wanted to do. There is a freedom in escape. 3 nights before we are to leave, Eve and I are in bed, making love. We are neither loud nor quiet. Gently, Eve places one of his hands against the back of my head, urging me toward his cock. I resist at first, but he is insistent in his desire, his hand pressed harder, fingers tangling into my hair and taking firm hold. It becomes difficult to breathe, but it also excites me, makes me wet as he carefully guides me, his hands gripping harder and harder, his breathing faster. Suddenly, he stops, roughly rolling me onto my chest, digging his fingers into my hips, pulling my ass into the air. I press my forehead against my arms, gritting my teeth. I allow Eve to enter me, whispering terrible words into the night as he rocks me. I feel so much pleasure, so much pain. The only thing I know is I want more. More of the dull ache and the sharp tingling. More of feeling like I will shatter into pieces if he pushes any further. More. Eve says my name, his voice so tremulous it makes my heart ache. It is nice to know he craves me in the same way, that my body clinging to his is a balm. Afterward, we lie side by side, our limbs heavy, and Eve talks to me about South Beach with the confidence of a man who has spent his entire life in such a place where rich people and beautiful people and famous people dance salsa at night and eat in fancy restaurants overlooking the water. He tells me of expensive cars that never break down and jobs for everyone. Good jobs where he can use his engineering degree and I can do whatever I want. He tells me about Little Haiti, a neighborhood just like our country, only better because the air conditioning always works and we can watch cable TV. The cable TV always comes up in our conversations. We are fascinated by its excess. He tells me all of this and I can feel his body next to mine, tense, almost twitching with excitement. Eve smiles more in 2 weeks than in the 3 years we have been married and the 24 years we have known each other, and I smile with him because I need to believe this idyllic place exists. I listen, even though I have doubts, and I listen because I don't know what to say. The boat will sail under the cover of night. On the evening of flight, I leave work as I always do, turning off all the lights and computers, smiling at the security guard, saying I will see everyone tomorrow. It is always when I am leaving work that I realize what an odd country Haiti is, with the internet, computers, fax machines, and photocopiers and offices, and the people who use them living in shacks with the barest of amenities. We are a people living in two different times. Eve is waiting for me as he always is, but today, he is wearing a nice pair of slacks and a button-down shirt and the black shoes he wears to church. This is his best outfit, only slightly faded and frayed. The tie his father gave him is hanging from his left pocket. We don't talk on the way home. We only hold hands and he grips my fingers so tightly my elbows start tingling. I say nothing, however, because I know that right now Eve needs something to hold on to. I want to steal away into the sugarcane fields we pass, ignoring the old men, dark, dirty, and sweaty as they wield their machetes. I want to find a hidden spot and beg Eve to take me right there. I want to feel the soil beneath my back and the stalks of cane cutting my skin. I want to leave my blood on the land and my cries in the air before we continue our walk home, Eve's seed staining my thighs, my clothes and demeanor hiding an intimate knowledge. But such a thing is entirely inappropriate, or at least it was before all this madness began. My face burns as I realize what I am thinking, and I start walking faster. I have changed so much in so short a time. My mother has changed as well. I would not say she is happy, but the grief that normally clouds her features is missing, as if she slid out of her shadow and hid it someplace secret and dark. We have talked more in 2 weeks than in the past 2 years. We will write, and someday Eve and I will save enough money to bring my mother to Miami, but nothing will ever make up for the wide expanse between now and then. By the time we reach our home, Eve and I are drenched in sweat. It is hot, yes, but this is a different kind of sweat. It reeks of fear and unspeakable tension. We stare at each other as we cross the threshold, each mindful of the fact that everything we are doing for the last time. My mother is moving about the kitchen, muttering to herself. Our suitcases rest next to the kitchen table, and it all seems rather innocent, as if we are simply going to the country for a few days and not across an entire ocean. I cannot rightly wrap my mind around the concept of crossing an ocean. All I know is this small island and the few feet of water I wade in when I am at the beach. Haiti is not a perfect home, but it is a home nonetheless. Last night, Eve told me he never wants to return, that he will never look back, and lying in bed, my legs wrapped around his, my lips against the sharp of his collarbone, I burst into tears. "Cher, what's wrong?" he asked, gently wiping my tears away with the soft pads of his thumbs. "I don't like it when you talk like that." Eve stiffened. "I love my country, and I love my people, but I cannot bear the thought of returning to this place where I cannot work or feel like a man or even breathe. I mean you no insult when I say this, but you cannot possibly understand." I wanted to protest, but as I lay there, my head pounding, I realized I probably couldn't understand what it would be like for a man in this country where men have so many expectations placed upon them that they can never hope to meet. There are expectations of women here, but it is, in some strange way, easier for us. It is in our nature, for better or worse, to do what is expected of us. And yet, there are times when it is not easier, times like that moment when I wanted to tell Eve we should stay and fight and make things better, stay with our loved ones. Just stay. I have saved a little money for my mother. It started with the 5 gourds from the red-faced American, and then most of my paycheck and anything else I could come up with. This money will not make up for the loss of a daughter and a son-in-law, but it is all I have. After we leave, she is going to stay with her sister in Petit Guave. I am glad for this. I could not bear the thought of her alone in this stifling little house day after day. I walk around the house slowly, memorizing each detail, running my hands along the walls, tracing each crack in the floor with my toes. Eve is businesslike and distant as he remakes our bed, fetches a few groceries for my mother, hides our passports in the lining of his suitcase. My mother watches us, but we are all silent. I don't think any of us can bear to hear the sound of each other's voices. I don't think we know why. Finally, a few minutes past midnight, it is time. My mother clasps Eve's hands between hers, smaller, more brittle. She urges him to take care of me, of himself. His voice cracks as he assures her he will, that the three of us won't be apart long. She embraces me tightly, so tightly that again my arms go numb. I hold her, kissing the top of her head, promising to write as soon as we arrive in Miami, promising to write every single day, promising to send for her as soon as possible. I make so many promises I cannot promise to keep. And then we are gone. We do not look back. We do not cry. Eve carries our suitcases, and quickly we make our way to a deserted beach where there are perhaps 30 others looking as scared as us. There is a boat. Large and far sturdier than I had imagined. I have been plagued by nightmares of a boat made from weak and rotting wood, leaking and sinking into the ocean, the only thing left behind the hollow echo of screams. Eve greets a few of his friends but stays by my side. "We're moving on up," I quip, and Eve laughs loudly. I see the priest Eve promised would bless this journey. He is only a few years older than us. He appears painfully young. He has only a small knapsack and a Bible so worn it looks like the pages might fall apart at the lightest touch. His voice is quiet and calm as he ushers us onto the boat. Below decks there are several small cabins, and Eve seems to know which one is ours. I realize Eve has spent a great deal of money to arrange this passage. He stands near the small bed, his arms shyly crossed over his chest, and I see an expression on his face I don't think I have ever seen before. He is proud, eyes watery, chin jutting forward. I will never regret this decision, no matter what happens to us. I have waited my entire life to see my husband like this. I see him for the first time. Later, I am above decks, leaning over the railing, heaving what little food is in my stomach into the ocean. Even on the water, the air is hot and stifling. We are still close to Haiti. I had hoped the moment we set upon the ocean I would be granted one sweet breath of cool air. Eve is cradling me against him between my bouts of nausea, promising the sickness will pass, promising this is but a small price to pay. I am tired of promises, but they are all we have to offer. I tell him to leave me alone, and he is hurt, but I can't comfort him when I need to comfort myself. I brush my lips across his knuckles and tell him I'll meet him in our cabin soon. He leaves, reluctantly, and when I am alone, I close my eyes, inhaling the salt of the sea deep into my lungs, hoping that smelling this thick, salty air is one more thing I am doing for the last time. I think of my mother and father, and I think that being here on this boat may well be the closest I will ever come to knowing my father, knowing what he wanted for his family. All I want is peace. I wipe my lips with the back of my hand, ignoring the strong taste of bile lingering in the back of my throat. I return below decks where I find Eve sitting on the end of the bed, rubbing his forehead. I place the palm of my hand against the back of his neck. It is warm and slick with sweat. What's wrong? He looks up, but not at me. I'm worried about you. I push him farther onto the bed and straddle his lap. He closes his eyes and I caress his eyelids with my fingers, enjoying the curl of his eyelashes and the way it tickles my skin. He is such a beautiful man, but I do not tell him this. He would take it the wrong way. It is a strange thing in some men, this fear of their own beauty. I lift his chin with one finger and trace his lips with my tongue. They are cracked but soft. His hands tremble, but he grips my shoulders firmly. I am amazed at how little is spoken between us, yet how much is said. We quickly slip out of our clothes, and his thighs flex between mine. The sensation of his muscle against my flesh is a powerful one that makes my entire body tremble. I slip my tongue between his lips, and the taste of him is so familiar and necessary that I am suddenly weak. I fall into Eve, kissing him so hard I know my lips will be bruised in the morning. I want them to be. Eve pulls away first, drawing his lips roughly across my chin, down to my neck, the hollow of my throat, practically gnawing at my skin with his teeth. I moan hoarsely, tossing my head backward. My neck throbs, and I know that here, too, there will be bruises. He sinks his teeth deeper into me, and I can no longer see the fine line between pain and pleasure. But just as soon as I consider asking him to stop, he does, instead lathering the fresh wounds with the softness of his tongue, murmuring sweet and tender words. Such gentleness in the wake of such roughness leaves me shivering. The weight of my breasts rests in Eve's hands, and he lowers his lips to my nipples, suckling them. He looks up at me, and it is unclear whether this is a moment of passion or a moment of comfort for him, for me. And then, I cannot look at him, so I rest my chin against the top of his head, my arms wrapped around him, my hips slowly rocking back and forth. I want him inside me, but I wait. This moment, whatever it is, demands patience. Eve takes hold of my knees, spreading my legs wide and pushing them upward until they are practically touching my face. I rest my ankles against his shoulders and shudder as he buries inside me. I feel his pulsing length, his sweat falling onto my body, into my eyes, mingling with mine, the tension in his body as I claw at the wide stretch of black skin across his back. Tomorrow, he too will have bruises. Let go, I urge him. Then he is fucking me faster, harder. We are greedy. I cannot recognize him. I am thankful. I scream. The sound of it is a horrible thing. I can feel wetness trailing down the inside of my arms, Eve's tears. I am tender inside, but I don't want Eve's to ever stop. With each stroke, he takes me further away from the sorrows of home and closer to a cool, dry place. Acknowledgements. Stories in this collection previously appeared in the following publications: Decomp, Quick Fiction, Pinch, Guernica, Necessary Fiction, Weave, Caribbean Review of Books, Transfer, Best Lesbian Erotica 2003 and Best American Erotica 2004. AYT was originally published by Artistically Declined Press in 2011. I am especially grateful to the editors of the fine magazines and anthologies where these pieces originally appeared. This book would not exist were it not for my parents, Michael and Nicole Gay, who raised my brothers and me to know and love where we come from. I write about Haiti and the Haitian-American experience from a place of great privilege, but also a place of great pride. Thanks also to Maria Massey, my indomitable agent. As always, I am grateful to my lovely friends who are so supportive of my work so consistently. And thank you to my best friend, Tracy Gonzalez, who is probably bored with being thanked, but will always be thanked anyway. She knows why. And also, she was right.
This has been an Audible Studios production of AYT, written and performed by Roxane Gay. Executive producers, Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Producer, Chris Sacco. Edited and mastered by Sarah Cosa. Copyright 2011-2018 by Roxane Gay. Recorded by arrangement with Grove Atlantic, Inc. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.